Good evening, friends. When our third child was born, Are we on now? One of these days, I'll figure out how these work. I'm only in my mid-60s, so I'll hit it someday. Our third child was born, and he had immune deficiency problems, so Diane had to stay home with him. And I was preaching for the Highland Church in Abilene at the time, so I'd go to early service and preach first service by myself, and then neighbors would bring the other two children. Well, our daughter was still alive at the time. She was mentally disabled and had to have special help, so Megan was out in the foyer marching around, singing her songs. But Matt was 10 at the time, and he would come up and sit right by me. I never asked him to, and he would sit right at the front of that cavernous auditorium right by me. And it meant so much to me. Sometimes I well up thinking about it. Just out of all the places he could have sat with other 10-year-olds, could have sat with our neighbors that brought him, but out of all the places he wanted to sit by his dad. And we were standing singing a song like that, and emotion just overcame me, and I leaned over and said, "Matt, it means so much to me that you sit by me." And he said three words I'll never forget. He said, "Mom makes me." Which every parent here understands. You'll take it anyway, right? You'll take it anyway. But I'm on the road a lot right now working for Pepperdine. Sometimes I wake up and think, who made me do this? But this weekend hadn't been like that. This has been relaxing to me to come to my wife's home state, born and graduated in Cuyahoga Falls. Columbus is where we rode past quickly on the way home for Thanksgiving or Christmas every other year. And so it's been nice to be here, and thank you to this church for hosting me. And then tonight, what a wonderful thing. I grew up with area wides like this, and it's a fond memory. Now, one of my roles for Pepperdine is I hold elder minister conferences, mostly from Denver west to the West Coast. And I'm always amazed that our churches don't know each other anymore. We just did one in Denver and one in Sacramento. At both places, there were 10 to 12 churches. And as I had them sit at tables and interact, it was clear nobody knew anybody. And so even though we overlap so much and we share so many things in this heritage, I hate the loss of that. So I'm really thankful that those of you who came over here, and I hope, is it every fifth Sunday? I hope that tradition continues. What a wonderful thing. And to whoever found that old YouTube video, shame on you. I had a crazy idea years ago. I grabbed an 18-year-old videographer from ACU, and we shot that in an hour. But I unfortunately didn't put it up on YouTube, so I can't take it down from YouTube. The funny thing is, it was the first year of YouTube. That wasn't really much of a thing yet. And back in that first year, every day, they would have top 10 awards in different categories. And believe it or not, I guess because of the Church of Christ connection, that had so many views the first day that we were in the top 10 for entertainment videos. Now, this is long before the Beyoncés of the world. And the funny thing is, right behind, I think we were like number 4. And number 5 was a video of Paris Hilton doing a pole dance. And so when people ask me, how good is it? I said, well, a little better than Paris Hilton pole dancing. Although, sadly, only a little better. We were just one of them. But, well, goodness, to be here tonight. And I don't get to speak to the rest of your churches. Just I think of Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, last verse, just saying, continue your labor in the Lord. It's not in vain. And wherever you are, whatever your church is doing, you guys that I met tonight, just starting your ministry, continue your work in the Lord. It's not in vain. And there are days that are a real trial, and times you think, are we just treading water and not moving? But the promise of the gospel is this work is not in vain. So what we've done this weekend is talk about finding God in ordinary life. that we don't have to coax God down here. We don't have to get him down by the right sacrifices or the right perfectly nailed lives or exactly nailing worship or doctrine or so on, but God is present. God has come himself in Jesus Christ, and through the power of the Holy Spirit is here among us. What we need is not to coax God down. We need to open our eyes and to see that the world is electric as altars of the living God. And like Jacob last night, if our eyes could be opened, we would say, how awesome is this place? I just wasn't aware. And not the church building per se, though that, sure, of course, but your living room, your backyard, the school you attend, the place you work, those are altars of the living God. And then this morning we were in Romans 16, a kind of quirky text, and all those names, the Trithenas and Triphoses and Epinetuses of the world that Paul enumerates, and to hear him speak and to realize that God is present among these common people. We always think these people in the Bible were super saints, but they probably weren't. They were just the folks around when the Bible got written. And they were just as annoying and just as wonderful as all the people in our churches. What we need is eyes to be opened to see the work of God among these folks. So tonight, I'll continue that series, but you didn't have to be here for the other two. Tonight, just about how God, as I look back in the rearview mirror of my life, has been present in the mundane events of life, the non-spectacular events. And so I'm going to tell you a story you already know well, but isn't that much of telling Bible stories? We overhear what we've already heard. And I start here that this woman I'm going to tell you about walks back to her home. She's been gone a few years, 10 years have passed. She walks back home, and as she walks in, the women who knew her so well are saying, is that her? Which is a funny thing to me, because, I mean, if we saw each other, even if 10 years have passed, we might notice each other have aged, but we wouldn't be wondering, is that really them? Except in extreme cases, I think. But when Naomi walks back into Jerusalem, she has aged with the kind of aging that plastic surgeons and Botox cannot deal with. It's the aging of grief. She's weathered by grief. And those of us who've suffered great grief, we know there is a kind of erosion of the soul. There is a weathering that wrinkles can't even begin to explain. So she walks in, and they're just saying, is this really Naomi? And I know, as I tell the story of Ruth tonight, I know what I'd like to do is fast forward to the part we call the love story, though there's so much more to it. But on behalf of sufferers everywhere, I want to linger in the first few verses. Because I'm telling you, we've given Job a lot of credit, maybe more than Job deserved at times, but there's another Job in the Old Testament, and her name is Naomi. She's a patron saint of sufferers. And so if you came in tonight and you're a little weary of hashtag blessed on Facebook, and people who have mountaintop to mountaintop experiences and yours doesn't seem to match that, well, let these words sink in. Open your Bibles to Ruth, or I believe this scripture is going to be on the screens. Ruth chapter 1. Is it up there? Okay. Oh, there it is. I just now realized my last time here. There it is, right up there. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. And the man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. And after they'd lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. Well, to say that Naomi suffered is undershooting it by quite a bit. Her suffering comes in waves, and it's wave after wave. And it began, wave number one is when the skies dry up and there's famine in the land. Kind of the opposite problem you've been having around here. But we've seen it. I do a lot of my work out in California, and it was just a few years ago that people wondered, will we ever have rain again out there? All the underground aquifers, the places that store the water, were dry. But we're a wealthy country. We compensate. We find water. But we also have cable television, so we're not unaware. There are parts of the world where famine translates into sunken cheeks and distended bellies and emaciated ribs. And that's what it would have been like in Bethlehem, which ironically means what? House of bread. To add insult to injury, the house of bread has no bread because bread needs rain and it's famine time. And so all over this little village of probably 200 or 300 people, families are sitting around wondering, can we make it one more season? Do we have enough grain to get one through one more year? And you just imagine that Elimelech and Naomi are having that discussion, and they don't want to leave home, but you've got to feed your family. And so they leave. And that's the first wave. But the second wave comes with where they wind up going. They go to the other side of the sea, to a place that no Israelite would ever dream of vacationing, to Moab of all places. You meet Moab in Genesis 19 when you realize that that nation came from an incestuous relationship between Lot and one of his daughters. And then in the book of Numbers, Numbers 25, you meet Moab again when the Israelites are coming home from Egypt. And they come to the border of Moab, and the women of Moab come out to the men of Israel. And there is a massive loss of life in the punishment of God. So much so that when you get to Deuteronomy 23 on the next screen, Deuteronomy 23, you read, "No Ammonite or Moabite or any other descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord, not even in the 10th generation. Do not seek a treaty of friendship with them as long as you live." Do you hear that? Right out of Genesis. No Moabites. For 10 generations, no friendships. They can't come into the assembly. And then we come to the book of Ruth, and the hero of the story is a Moabitess. Which is a lovely reminder that you need to know the law really well so you know when to break the law. A principle I don't care for, but neither did the Pharisees. And so here we are in the book of Ruth, and we are in the land of Moab. But then there's a third wave of grief, because Elimelech dies. And that leaves Naomi among the sisterhood of sufferers in the world, the widows in poor country who have no safety net. But at least we think, well, at least she's got her sons. And she does. She's got Kilion and Mahlon. The problem is there's not a very good daughter-in-law pool when you're over in Moab. Moab, not every mother's dream to have your sons marry a Moabite woman, but that's who are there. So Kilion marries Orpah, and Mahlon marries Ruth. But the fourth wave of grief comes because nobody can get pregnant. That's the ultimate hope, right? The ultimate hope is that there'll be another child and there'll be somebody to support Naomi in her old age. But, and do the math with me, it's 10 years, 12 months a year, two women. That's 240 disappointments. 240 times the word comes back, no pregnancy. And then the fifth wave, it's hard for me to speak about, having buried a child myself, to come to the fifth wave and realize that Naomi buries both of her children. The boys die. Mahlon, Kilion. And what we have now is three powerless widows in Moab with no safety net. Well, that's why I said, when I start naming heroes of the Old Testament, I want to put Naomi's name down there because it'd be a good time to quit. And at least she's honest. She says to everybody, God's walked out of this story. God doesn't want anything to do with me. At the end of the chapter, when she goes home, she's explaining, yeah, God doesn't want anything to do with me. And at least I love that Scripture allows something like that to be said, because I've thought that a few times, just wasn't quite as bold as she was to say it. But sometimes it's the saying of it that allows the power of the statement to be taken away, because people can walk in and assure you that God will never leave you or forsake you, no matter what the moment may seem. And then we get to verse 6 of chapter 1, and we realize that now the winds have shifted, the rains have come, the bread is back in the house of bread, God has come to the rescue of his people, and so all three of the women head back to Naomi's home. They're going back to Bethlehem, and it's like all of a sudden Naomi goes boing on the way, just like, wait a minute, I'm from there, you girls aren't from there. I'm not going to have any more sons, go back home. And initially both of them grab her and they weep, they cry it out. No, we're going with you. But Naomi doubles down and says, no, you're not going with me. Well, it turns out Orpah's the reasonable one and the obedient one. And so she goes back to Moab. But not Ruth. Here's what Ruth says. Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back. Where you go, I'll go. Where you stay, I'll stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. Isn't that wonderful? Now, I'm old enough. I've been doing weddings for a long time. And I did a lot of weddings back in the 1980s when about every wedding I did, some of you remember the song, "Whither Thou Goest, I Will Go." Almost every wedding, they did that song right from there. The funny thing is, it was inappropriate in many ways. One wedding, I wanted the bride to turn around and sing it to her future mother-in-law. And that would have matched it, right? Just to turn around, where you go, I'll go. Your people be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I'll die. Where you're buried, I'll be buried. There's a kind of radical commitment on the part of this Moabite woman to her Israelite mother-in-law. And don't miss, by the way, that there's the implication of conversion here. Your God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, your God will be my God. And so they go back to Bethlehem. And that's where I started, the scene where these two women walk into Bethlehem and the women around say, can that be Naomi? And Naomi hears it and says, no, don't anybody call me Naomi, because that means pleasant. You call me Mara, that means bitter, because the Lord has left. And she says, I left this town full, and I have come back with nothing. To which I think Ruth was thinking, none taken, you know. Just made the big commitment, came back with you, but that's fine. Give grieving people their distance, you know. People have been nice to me. Well, chapter 2. So here they are back in Bethlehem, but that doesn't fix everything, because you still got to eat. And so the younger one is going to go out and she's going to work in the field, the barley field. Thankfully, in the world of God's laws in Israel, just because it was your land doesn't mean it was entirely your land. You were farming it on behalf of God, the owner of everything. And so when you go out into the fields and you're threshing and some of it falls to the ground, you leave it there, because that's for the poor. And when you come to the corners, you just leave the corners right there. That's a way of designating that some people are going to need food, and that land may have your name on the property, but it's not yours. And so she takes advantage of the justice and the mercy of the way of the people of God, and she goes out. And she just jumps in. And I love chapter 2. Can you see in the beginning there? It said it was the land that just happened to belong to Boaz. Now, I love that. I love that. One of the things people haven't liked about Ruth is that God isn't mentioned much in there. And he's not mentioned much. But those of us who've lived our lives have come to be suspicious of playful statements like, it just happened to belong to Boaz. And we can imagine the writer going, wink, wink, yeah, just happened to belong to Boaz. Because Boaz is a relative of the dead father-in-law of Elimelech, though Ruth doesn't know that at the time. So she goes out into the field behind the servant girls, and she starts working. And then Boaz shows up, master of the house. And I love that when he comes, now, again, we want this to be a love story, but it's not really as much as we've thought. He comes in, and his first words to his people are, "Yahweh bless you, my friends." So that's telling us something about Boaz, right? And their response to him, like they do it every day, is, "And Yahweh bless you, sir." And then he notices this young woman out there in the field, and he wants to know who that is. And what he's told is not, "Wow, she's a looker, isn't she?" He's not told that she's beautiful. He's not told anything like that. He's told this woman made a commitment to this Israelite woman that is just unbelievable. She has shown, and they borrow the Hebrew word that was in chapter 1 about God. It's the word chesed. She's shown steadfast love. She's shown kindness. And as they describe what this Moabite woman has done for this Israelite woman, Boaz is just blown away. So he calls for, and he says in verse 11, "I've been told all about what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with the people you didn't know before. May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose," and pay attention to this word because we'll come back to it and it'll be on a screen later, "the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Don't you love that? And then he says, "And not only that, but I want you to go out in the field and we'll take care of you. You don't have to go behind the servant girls. You go with them. And when you need water, you don't have to run home. You'll miss too much of the harvest. You come get water with my people and then you go back out into the field." And then he went to his work and said, "By the way, drop a little extra grain in the field. Let her harvest." And at the end of that day, she's gathered 30 pounds of barley grain. Now, you've carried a 20-pound sack of potatoes or a 20-pound bag of ice, and you know it's all you can do to lug that thing around. 30 pounds is quite a bit of food for two women. And she goes home. And Naomi says, "Who is this guy?" And she said, "I don't know. His name Boaz or something." And she said, "Boing, Boaz! That's our kinsman redeemer. He's the guy that could step into this story and redeem us." Then at the end of the chapter, you just have more stories of Ruth going back out through barley season and even into wheat season. And then we get to chapter 3 and verse 1. And Naomi at some point says, "Ruth, come in here. It's time. This man is clearly interested in you. Time to take off your widow's clothes, slip on a nice dress, take a bath, a little Chanel number 5. You go back out in the field tonight. You let Boaz eat and drink. And when he goes to bed, you go crawl in with him." And by the way, yes, this is just as awkward as it sounds. Except that we Westerners only know one way to do proposals, right? We've got our way. Then today it involves friends following around with videos and capturing and putting it on YouTube and so on. Back there, it could be as simple as a woman who knows that this man could redeem our story, and she offers herself, and that itself is a marriage proposal. And so she does just that. She crawls in bed with him. And then we get this passage. He's a bit startled, as I think you would be, when you went to bed alone and you wake up and there's a woman next to you. He says, "Who are you?" And she said, "I'm your servant Ruth." She said, "Spread the corner of your garment." And you see the two things I put in yellow? The funny thing is it's the same Hebrew word, kanaf. Back in chapter 2, he says to her, "May God's kanaf be over you." And there we translate it as wings. But she picks up on that and she says, what I'm suggesting is that you spread your kanaf over me. In other words, sometimes God does his work through other people. You suggested God would take care of us. Perhaps God's going to do this through your commitments. And he says, verse 10, chapter 3 and verse 10, he says, "Well, this," again, the word chesed, kindness or steadfast loyalty, he said, "This kindness is just beyond what I could imagine." And he says, but I want to tell you once again, you are an," now listen to this, I'll get off the Hebrew here a little bit, but he says, "You are an Eshet Kail." Now, has anybody ever done a Beth Moore study or something like that so that sounds familiar? Eshet Kail is the phrase that's in Proverbs 31. It means worthy woman. Like in Proverbs 31, that woman that's driven some of you crazy, you know, because she can do everything all at once, you know, superwoman. Well, in most Hebrew Bibles, the book after Proverbs is Ruth. And so it's almost as if you want to know what an Eshet Kail looks like, what a worthy woman looks like. Here she is, Ruth. Ruth is an Eshet Kail. She's a worthy woman. She is a woman who stepped into God's story, and she's made commitments that cost her something. And he says, but, here's something that Ruth didn't know yet, but I'm not the closest person. So he doesn't take advantage of the situation sexually. He just tells her, this is the situation. I've got to check with this guy and see if he wants the rights to step into the story. So the next morning, Ruth goes home. He gives her 6 big loads of grain again, and she tells Naomi. Naomi, knowing men pretty well, says, I don't think this will take long. And sure enough, in the beginning of chapter 4, Boaz calls a meeting at the city gates, and the kinsman redeemer who's closer comes, and Boaz says, here's the situation you want in. And the guy looks at it, and it sounds like it's all up with no downside, and he says, I'm in. And Boaz says, by the way, it comes with 2 widows, and if you have any kids, then the land is going to default back to Elimelech and his family. And the guy says, oh, too big a downside, I'm out. And Boaz says, then I'm in. And he marries Ruth. They have a baby named Obed. And you know the rest of the story there. Obed has a baby named Jesse, and Jesse has a baby named David. And then the story is picked up from there in Matthew chapter 1 as we get to the story of Jesus the Messiah. But that's later. Let me just hit the pause button on that and come back and just say for a moment that the thing that strikes me about Ruth, the book of Ruth, is how unspectacular it is. There are no fiery prophets, no mighty kings, no charismatic movements of anything. You hardly get God mentioned. What you've got, well, the summary, it sounds like an old hackneyed joke. Have you heard the one about the farmer and 2 widows? And that's the story of Ruth. It's just not spectacular. It begins by saying, in the time the judges judge, but honestly, there's no Samson, there's no Gideon, there's no Deborah. None of those stories are here. Just Naomi hanging on when she feels like dying. Just Ruth going out and harvesting because you got to eat. Just Boaz doing the right thing because he knows he's not yet the one who has the right. The story's moved along in such unspectacular ways. And I think that's why I've loved this story. It doesn't escape my notice that my most influential grandparent was named Ruth. Because honestly, I lived one of the most boring lives one could imagine. I came from the part of the country the Beverly Hillbillies left as soon as they could. I'm from the Ozarks. My elementary school, I was raised in Neosho, Missouri. My elementary school was named Field School. Like, really? Did you run out of names? My third grade teacher, my most influential teacher, was Mrs. Land. I had Mrs. Land at Field School. In fourth grade, we graduated from elementary school and we went to an intermediate school. In Neosho, they cleverly named the intermediate school Intermediate School. It was so nondescript, they didn't name it. My most memorable middle school experience, intermediate experiences, in fourth grade, I'm just, you know, you're there with the big sixth graders. You know, I'm a little fourth grade boy. And I got sick, so I went to the principal's office. And there was an Amazon woman behind the counter. And I said, I'm sick and I need to go home. Which was my version of, I want my mommy, but you can't say that in intermediate. And she said, do you have a letter from your mother or father? And I said, she said, you cannot go home. There's only one way you can go home. You must have a letter from your mother or father. And I said, but I didn't know I was going to be sick. And she said, well, I'm sorry. You cannot go home unless you have a letter from your mother or father. Would you like me to call your mother? And I said, please. Well, it's before cell phones, of course. So she calls 4-5-1-4-4-9-3. I know the number because it's still my mom's number today. Ring, 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 ring. No answer. Mom's probably outside. You know, it's so different. Most of you don't pre-cell phone days. If you missed, you missed. So she says, I'm sorry, you can't go home. There's only one way you can go. I got it. You got to have a letter from your mother or your father. And she said, but if you'd like to have a seat. And it was at that moment, with no warning, that I vomited all over that woman. I erupted. I was Vesuvius and she was Pompeii. If it had been lava instead of vomit, she would still be encased in it today. Children in the Ozarks would make field trips today to see that woman. What was life like in the 1960s? Well, there she is, just encased in lava. I'm 63, and it's still my gold medal vomiting performance right then and there. By the way, turns out there were two ways you could go home. A letter from your mother or vomit on the associate principal. And I punched my ticket home that day. But that was it. My life, my obituary is not going to be in the New York Times one day. I think I brought this. One day I used to go, but long before I preached at Pepperdine, I'd go out about every year. They'd have me come speak in their convocation, their chapel. Once a week they have convocation. And every year, you know, they'd want a little bio, so I'd send a bio. One year there was a new dean, and he was going to try to ramp it up a little bit. And so I sent my bio, and it got rejected. I still have his note to me. Mike, here are a few examples from last semester. Each one contains a short quote from the speaker as well. Thanks for taking time to redo this. Redo my bio? Let's be clear about what he's saying. So here we go. Steve Arrington. Steve Arrington's story begins in the jungles of Vietnam, where he's introduced to marijuana. That faulty step shatters his Navy career as a bomb disposal frogman, plunges him into the underworld of drug smuggling, and sentences him to the terrors of prison. There, amid brutal inmates and stifling depression, Steve discovers hope through a life-changing relationship with God. Soon, Steve is in deep water again, but this time surrounded by great white sharks as chief diver for the Cousteau Society. I went from a world of darkness into an incredible new life, Steve says. Second example, Bernice King. Bernice King was only 5 years old when her father, civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., was assassinated. Today she amazes people by following in her father's footsteps, becoming a minister. King says, look, we have a problem. We really need to sit down and dig into it and deal with it. In Bernice's voice, you'll hear echoes of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but the vision is now her own. And I thought, oh, that's good. The third one he sent me was Sue Thomas. At the age of 18 months, Sue was watching television with her family when she suddenly went deaf. Sue responded by turning up the volume full blast and was sent to her room. The next day, realizing there was something drastically wrong, Sue's parents took her to the hospital where they learned that nothing could restore her hearing loss. Since then, Sue has spent endless hours working with voice and drama coaches. Because of her outstanding lip-reading ability, Sue eventually worked for the FBI as an undercover surveillant. I still have what I wrote to him. I said, Mike Cope's spiritual crisis began when he realized that he hated the song Booster, Booster, Be a Booster. And I think, there's not much. I've gotten to speak a lot of places, but in our tiny little pond, our tiny little group, just mostly life's been non-spectacular. L.A. Times, New York Times, none of them will know when I die. But kind of like the people here, I mean, the people in Ruth, if it weren't for the genealogy at the end, these are not the kind of people who get their handprints and footprints in Hebrews 11, right? But the truth is, my dear friends, these lives we're living, turns out they matter. That it's in these stories, these these less than spectacular stories. Oh yeah, once in a while God does raise up a well-known, mighty evangelist, internationally known. And once in a while there are these big stories, and there's Kent Brantley, you know, serving the people with Ebola, and he comes home and he's Times Man of the Year, and we're thankful for every one of those stories. But the truth is, most of us are going to live our lives in relative obscurity. And the good news is that these lives matter. When you go through a day where the biggest thing you did was balance your checkbook, that matters. When all you did was change a few diapers and get some breakfast on the plate, that's kingdom work. When you share with a neighbor who's lost somebody that there is hope, that's kingdom work. When you punch out faithfully at 5 o'clock and you battle traffic getting home and you don't lose your mind, it's kingdom work. I think it's so easy for us to think, oh man, I wish I could have done this, could have done that. But the real kingdom stories are found in these daily events. It's not just the big ones. The average faithful ways. It's Naomi navigating grief. It's Boaz blessing Ruth. It's Ruth harvesting grain to make sure her mother-in-law can eat. Those are the big stories here. And then at the end, and there's this amazing thing of Obed and Jesse and David, yes, I know, because that's what God always does. And then the New Testament, you find out, and that's the storyline of Jesus Christ. And that whole story is less than spectacular in the beginning, right? That's why everybody is baffled. It's in Bethlehem to Mary and Joseph, these poor people that are displaced. It wasn't the kind of experience one... It wasn't Alexander the Great riding in on a great white steed. No, it was the quiet entrance into a barn, a stable. Well, one more thing I want to point out, and that is chapter 4. I think this is going to be up on the screen there, chapter 4 and verse 1. I love that at the end, you realize everybody seems to be named almost. You get Elimelech, Naomi, Mahlon, Chilion, Ruth, Orpah. But they're... somebody that doesn't get named. So here it is, Ruth 4:1. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there just as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. Boaz said, "Come over here, Ploni Almoni, and sit down." Now, I put the Hebrew phrase, Ploni Almoni. My Bible just, what's yours say? Something like, my friend? Because we don't know what it means. It's a funny phrase, kind of like hocus pocus, double trouble. The best we can tell, the phrase Ploni Almoni just means something like the dude without a name. Like we say John Doe. Do we still use that? John Doe. That means somebody's coming. We've got their seat right here. We don't know who it's coming. She's bringing a guest. We don't know his name. That's John Doe. Well, apparently, in that society, the equivalent of John Doe was Ploni Almoni. By the way, thanks, I'm sure, to some less than reverent Hebrew students. There are all kinds of Ploni Almoni presence out in the social media world. And in the next slide, you can see there is, let's see if we can get that up there, Ploni Almoni coffee cups. That's you can buy all kinds of things, and they're just kind of making fun of this phrase that's there. But Ploni Almoni just means the guy we're not going to name. For Harry Potter fans, he who must not be named. Not because he's evil, but just because it was too inconvenient for him to get into this story. Elimelech's in, Mahlon's in, Chilion's in, Naomi's in, Orpah's in, and Ruth is especially in. They all are moving the story forward. Boaz is going to do the next right thing no matter what it takes. But Ploni Almoni finds out that there's some downside and he's out. So he's not even going to get his real name in there. But all these other people, they're here. And it just makes me think, I know we wish our churches were just busting loose and growing fast. I know we wish that our church would go from whatever it is today to 1,000 tomorrow. I know that. And I know most of us wish we could have a huge kingdom impact. But I'm really convinced at this point in my life that the greatest work of the kingdom is God's people doing the next right thing because they believe in the risen Christ. And when you keep your commitments to your family, that's amazing kingdom work. When you love the people that are hard to love at church, that's amazing kingdom work. When you go to your job, when you take care of your children, when you do all of those things, you are participating in the kingdom work of God, which is why I began in 1 Corinthians 15, just keep doing your labor in the Lord. It is not in vain. And that may look some days like the Apostle Paul on his third missionary journey changing the world, or it may look like Ruth going out and doing another day's work to make sure somebody gets fed. Once again, we don't have to coax God down into these events of our lives. We just need to open our eyes and see that He is here. Because your lives, my dear friends, your lives are spectacular. Your lives matter in what God's doing in this world. And God's blessing you that He might bless the whole world. And let's close on that blessing and pray together. I give you thanks, O God, for these churches represented here tonight. And I ask that our eyes may be open to see that you are in our common places, among common people, and the daily events of our lives. And toward that end, we realize that what we do in our lives do matter. And we give you thanks for that. New York Times may not know it, may not recognize it, but you do, and nothing escapes you. So use us for the long haul of your faithful kingdom work. In the name of Jesus, we pray, and we all say, amen.